Today for the Bitcoin price with Michael Saylor, the one and only one, you know him. He actually invested hundreds of millions, even billions into Bitcoin of his personal portfolio and also with MicroStrategy. Today, I want to ask very important questions, not only about money printing, about possible price predictions, about his conversations with Elon Musk and much, much more. So I want to urge you guys to watch this video until the very end, where I am going to bring the most interesting content, because I actually scheduled it that way that the more time passes, the more interesting these questions become. So make sure you take a seat, you scroll down, you smash up the like button on that video, you leave some thoughts and questions in the comment section down below, and you share this video with your friends. But with that being said, I want to come today to the most important question of today. Michael Saylor, how are you doing today, my man?
I'm awesome. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm also very happy to be here. And I was joking with my friends, because you are probably the youngest Bitcoin OG in the whole crypto space, because usually people investing in Bitcoin in 2010 or 2011 are called the OGs. But you invested just like a few months ago. You ever like researched about Bitcoin in March. So I'm truly happy to have you here. And I actually think that you are one of the drivers, like PayPal, like Square, like GreenPro and many other institutions, behind the recent price increases. But we will talk about that later on. First of all, I wanted to ask you about your discussion with Elon Musk. I saw you had a quick chat with him on Twitter where you offered him to share your Bitcoin playbook. And probably if there was a discussion, you cannot share any details, I know, but maybe you can share, was there any discussions outside of Twitter?
What an awesome question. Look, the entire world knows what I said to Elon Musk on Twitter. And my view is that's the same thing I would say to any big tech company. Like, they all should be thinking about plugging their balance sheet or their P&L into the Bitcoin monetary network, right? And so I think that he was interested, and he responded to me on Twitter, because it's a captivating idea, but it's a straightforward idea. I mean, Bitcoin is a great monetary network. If you're sitting with a balance sheet of dollars, they're debasing. So why wouldn't you want to convert your dollars into Bitcoin so it appreciates instead of debases in value? And, I expect that lots and lots of other CEOs will be thinking about the same thing in the coming year.
Yeah, I actually agree with that. And I have a lot of respect between your discussions with other people in this space. So I'm not going to push forward here. Everyone can maybe make their own thoughts about it. In the end, only time will tell. But I actually think as the time progresses, we see now the frequency of more billionaires and billion-dollar entities actually getting shorter and shorter. And in the end of the day, it's just game theory. Everyone will be forced to join Bitcoin, because the more people join, the more valuable the network becomes, probably, right? So anyway, thank you so much for asking, for answering that question. And I also have a friend here in Dubai. I'm based in Dubai. He is a multi-billionaire. And I recently had a podcast with him for his channel, and I had to convince him to buy Bitcoin. And I just experienced that one of his biggest thoughts, or like one of his biggest fears to buy Bitcoin, is actually upcoming regulations. So I wanted to know from you, what are your thoughts about regulations, or what would you actually tell other multi-billionaires, whether they should fear regulations or not, specifically when it comes to Bitcoin, not other crypto assets?
Well, I think that Bitcoin has emerged as an institutional grade safe haven asset in the year 2020. And as people start to appreciate its identity as digital gold, I think they realize that it's totally proper for institutions to hold gold, and all institutions want a safe haven asset. And as digital gold, Bitcoin's probably going to have the same sort of regulations that a physical gold or any other safe haven asset would have. There'll be licensed custodians, the KYC, AML rules. But once you actually wrap Bitcoin with those same regulations that govern other large institutional safe haven assets, then it's regularized and normalized. So if anything, it's pretty clear Bitcoin's got normal tax treatment. It's property tax treatment by the IRS. It's been normalized by the SEC. It's been deemed as property. It's been normalized by the OCC. Banks can custody it and they can move it around. And so if anything, I think people's concerns about regulation are much stronger when they get confused about what Bitcoin is. When they start thinking it's a currency, like the term cryptocurrency is very confusing. It's not really a currency. When they think it's a currency, they think it needs to be a payment network or a medium of exchange. And it isn't, and it doesn't need to be. And so if you want it to be a currency, then the fact that you get taxed every time that you pay someone with it is hostile, right? In fact, it's crippling. It can't be a currency with the current tax law. It can't be. And therefore, it isn't a payment network. And therefore, all the rules around currencies are really irrelevant and don't represent a threat to Bitcoin. I think people that criticize it, they'll criticize it for being not used as a currency or not fast enough for transactions, but they're irrelevant criticisms. If you just lock onto the idea that Bitcoin's digital gold, and you're just going to stack it up like virtual gold bars in cyberspace, then I think you get pretty comfortable with it. Then it's pretty obvious why you want it. It's a lot better gold than gold. At some point, I would think that all the gold bugs will realize that gold just doesn't work. It doesn't. It's not appreciating in value. It's not a safe haven anymore. Its performance is abysmal. And so why in the world do you have any money invested in gold in the modern era when you could flip it over to Bitcoin?
Yeah, I agree. And we have like so many properties Bitcoin is sharing with gold. And then so many properties on top of that, which are even better than gold. You have more divisibility, more portability. It is more scarce because we have an absolute maximum supply, which can never be inflated. And then in the end of the day, there will be trust issues in the future. It's not confiscatable. You can just save 12 words in your brain and no one can ever dock onto your mind and take these 12 words away, right? So that is truly amazing. And so I want to go directly here to the next question. You made the comparison with gold. So let's compare gold to Bitcoin. The market cap of gold is right now approximately hovering around 9 or 10 trillion. So this should be approximately, what is it actually, like 12 times higher than Bitcoin right now. We just have some high price increases recently. Taking the properties of gold and taking the properties of Bitcoin, do you think as of right now that Bitcoin is more valuable or undervalued towards gold? And do you think that Bitcoin should take some of the market cap of gold or maybe even surpasses because it is superior? What are your thoughts about that?
I think that the only reason that that people haven't sold all their monetary gold and bought Bitcoin is ignorance, fear, uncertainty. Like as the fear, uncertainty, and doubt disappears, then it seems pretty obvious that the $10 trillion that's sitting in gold should that energy should drain into Bitcoin, and Bitcoin should grow at least to the monetary value of gold and then beyond. Because the reasons people buy gold are they want a hard to debase store of value, and Bitcoin is everything that gold is but better. And so the only people that are holding gold are people that just don't understand Bitcoin, or they don't trust it because it's new. Because so there's a generational change. As generations change, they'll start to trust it. And then there's an educational component. But you can see right now, if you go back 6 months and look at the price of gold 6 months ago versus today, it's gone nowhere. And go back 6 months, look at the price of Bitcoin versus today, You know, it's up by like nearly a factor of four. And so at some point, the price becomes the educator, right? The educational catalyst. And all of the hedge funds that are holding gold and Bitcoin, they're holding gold because they want a store of value against currency debasement and uncertainty. They're realizing the gold didn't work that well, or at least as they start to compare it to Bitcoin, they're like, well, everything I thought I was going to get from gold is going to Bitcoin. And so if I basically invested half my portfolio in gold and half in Bitcoin, half the portfolio works, half doesn't work. And if I have 75% in gold and 25% in Bitcoin, or 98% in gold and 2% in Bitcoin, well, 2% works, 98% doesn't work. And so there's an entire generation of macroeconomic investors this year in the last 12 months. I think they dipped their toe into Bitcoin and they had a good experience and they had a bad experience with gold. And so the logical thing to do is you rebalance your portfolio in the coming year and you increase your exposure to Bitcoin and you decrease your exposure to gold. And of course, if you reason from first principles, you know, like every people, you know, in the community that are thinking hard about it, their conclusion is, well, 100% of my portfolio ought to go into Bitcoin and 0% into gold. Why would you invest in an antiquated, obsolete store of value that's defective? Like, why would you put any money? It's like basically I have wooden ships and I have steel ships. And 100 years ago, people had wooden ships and it worked 100 years ago because there was no steel, but now we have steel ships. Now, why would you have half your Navy be wooden ships and the other half be steel ships in the modern era? It makes no sense.
It's true, yeah. But in the end of the day, gold still has like a 5,000 years history. So do you think this 5,000 years, or like as a medium of exchange or as a store of value, do you think this history is going to be obsolete and Bitcoin is completely going to take over?
Wooden ships are 5,000 years old. And how many, you know, naval aircraft carriers are made of wood? By the way, like... We didn't have airplanes for 5,000 years. You know, everyone that ever went between Europe and the US went on a wooden ship for 500 years. And now how many people go on wooden ships today? Right? We had horses. How many people ride horses? There are plenty of things in the world that are 5,000 years old, right? By the way, dying of an infection because there are no antibiotics, that's 500,000 years old. People have been dying without antibiotics for hundreds of thousands of years. Would you use antibiotics if you got sick and it was going to save your life? Penicillin is not 100 years old. You know, for a billion people died of tuberculosis over the last 5,000 years. And we solved it with penicillin. Are you going to tell me that you don't want to use the new cure because it's 5,000 years old honey cure is the right way to do it? I mean, the truth is saying something's 5,000 years old is the same as just saying, I just choose not to think about the matter. You know, for 5,000 years before we had guns, we had bows and arrows. How many people bring a bow and arrow to a fight with a person with a gun? That's 5,000-year-old proven technology too. They're all silly, right? I mean, they're silly notions. We used to do it another way, and now we have a new way. But I refuse to learn the new way because it's the new way.
True. I mean, I wonder how you just put all of these 20 arguments out of your hand here, just like in 20 seconds. Beautiful. I will take a snippet and send it over to Peter Schiff. Thank you so much for that. And let's take it one step further. So if Bitcoin takes over the gold market cap, that would bring Bitcoin actually at, let's just calculate it by 20 million coins and a market cap of 10 billion to $500,000. I personally think this is a price target, which at least in the next few years, I'm going to hold my Bitcoin forever. I'm holding 95% of my net worth in Bitcoin. But I think this is an achievable target. So thank you so much for these thoughts. But I actually listened to one of your interviews. It was a great one. I forgot the channel. I will put the link down below, where you actually said that Facebook as a network, which also has network effects, of course, stores social energy, whereas Bitcoin stores monetary energy. And you said something which really caught my attention over there, because what you said there is pretty much in alignment what I'm personally also thinking or predicting throughout the next maybe 10 years or so. And you said that if Bitcoin stores social energy and Bitcoin stores monetary energy, then Bitcoin should be valued 100 times more than Facebook. So I just checked it. The valuation of Facebook is 800 billion. Let's just round it up to 1 trillion here. And if Bitcoin actually takes over that and 100x's that, that would be 100 trillion, which actually would soak up somehow the vast majority of monetary energy in the world. And that would bring Bitcoin to a valuation of $5 million. Was this just a saying, or do you actually also believe that Bitcoin can soak up monetary energy in that regards, that we are reaching a valuation of $5 million per Bitcoin anytime in the future?
I think that demonetizing gold gets you to 500,000. And that's simply pulling all the monetary energy off of the gold rock from gold bugs who believe that gold is a store of value and a safe haven. But it's important to note, there are a lot of organizations and a lot of investors that don't use gold as their safe haven. They use government debt, sovereign debt. And so cash is a safe haven, and sovereign debt is a safe haven. And another safe haven people use as a store of value is an index fund, bond index funds and stock index funds, like the Russell 2000, the S&P 500, the Dow index. So all told, I think there's between $300 and $400 trillion worth of fiat instruments, cash, debt, stock, commercial real estate indexes, something in that range. They're all, if you look at all of that, half of that monetary energy, maybe more, between 50 and 75%, is simply seeking a store of value as a container. Like when I buy the S&P 500 index or the Vanguard fund, I'm not buying it because I equally love all 500 S&P stocks equally in proportion to their market caps. That's not why I bought the index. I bought the index because I had $1 million and I knew if it was cash, it would be debased in purchasing power. And so I needed to put it into something which was going to return more than the economic hurdle rate or the cost of capital. So some people choose to preserve their wealth by investing in gold. Some people choose to preserve their wealth by buying land, a land bank. I'm just going to buy a bunch of farmland. I don't love it. I just bought it. Some people choose to preserve their wealth by buying debt. Like there's like $100 trillion worth of sovereign debt, right? 10-year treasuries, 30-year treasuries, 3-year, 1-year treasuries. There's like $17 trillion worth of debt that's negative yielding, I think the last number I saw. Why would you buy a bond that you have to pay to own? Right? Isn't the obvious answer? It's a safe haven. I don't want to bury the cash. I don't want to hold cash. I don't want to bury the cash under my mattress. I don't want to hold metal. And so I'll buy a bond until I figure out what to do. So ultimately, the amount of monetary energy in the world that's looking for a safe haven store of value is got to be between 100 trillion and 250 trillion. Like why not all of it? Like why not 300 trillion or 350 trillion? If whatever the total sum of everything. Well, the answer is at the right price, I would own a stock because I believe in the stock. Like for example, Tesla. If you bought Tesla at the beginning of the year, it went up by a factor of 5. And if you love Tesla and if you believe it's a growth stock, then you invest. You're making an investment decision. I might make an investment decision in a stock that I thought was going to grow faster than the cost of capital. If you believe that a stock can grow its revenues and its cash flows more than 20% a year, you should probably own the stock, right? If the stock is going to outperform the cost of capital. If you came to me and you asked for a loan and you were going to erect a hospital, and I lived in the city and I had kids and we needed a hospital and I was a wealthy person, I would give you the loan. I would buy the bond so that you could build a hospital so that my family doesn't die if they need the hospital. So sometimes creditors would issue credit because they have a passionate belief in the project. And equity investors would invest because they have a passionate belief. That's investment and that's true crediting. I mean, credit and equity investments. And the same is true with real estate, right? I might buy real estate to live in. I love it, or buy a commercial office building to put my company in, or a factory. On the other hand, when I'm buying the index of 187 companies I never heard of that yields me 2% or 3%, I'm just looking for a store of value. So that's a long-winded answer to the question, which is, you know, is Bitcoin worth more than the value of gold? And the answer is, yeah, in theory, all monetary energy that's simply looking for a store of value safe haven index should presumably drain out of real estate, cash, stocks, and bonds into the Bitcoin network. And as that happens, the price discovery will return to real estate and bond, right? A real bond should not pay you 0% interest, right? A real bond should not charge you money to own it, right? That's offensive. So the bond values will fall. The equity values will fall. The real estate values will fall. The yields, the dividend yields, the rent yields, the bond coupon yields, they will go up until a rational actor would choose to own those as an investment, or a person that's a passionate investor will own them because they're trophy assets that they simply wish to own to say they own them for their own personal purposes. And the rest of the monetary energy really ought to be in a Bitcoin network because it's a pure index of the economy without counterparty risk, without execution risk, without credit risk, you know, without debasement and political risk, without the tax risk, et cetera, and the political risk. That's why that makes sense. And that means that the top is more than 100 million, more than 100 trillion. It's somewhere between 100 trillion and 300 trillion in today's money. And of course, if we look out 5 or 10 years, there may be 700 trillion in today's money then. So if half of the monetary energy sits in a store of value index, then it could be $300 or $400 trillion.
All right, Michael. So if I put that into perspective, 300 trillion, that would be probably a valuation of $15 million, talking in today's purchasing power, probably. But then if you take into consideration that the Federal Reserve, the People's Bank of China, the European Central Bank, that they are actually printing 24/7, the number itself could be even higher.
There's twice as much money or three times as much money. So maybe it would be half or a third of today's purchasing power, or we don't know how that's going to adjust. So it'll be less purchasing power, but nominally more. You're kind of talking about, remember the Vanguard 500 fund or the S&P index? You're kind of talking about creating a cyber index of the entire world global economy on the blockchain, on the Bitcoin network. And what it does is it returns price discovery and rationality to every part of the world that it touches, and it will create a check and balance on unmitigated money printing, and it gives people an option, right? It gives optionality to individuals. If I if I live in a country on a ranch, or I have money in a country and the country is printing the currency to drive it to zero, and I don't have an option to store my value, I'm going to lose everything. But if I can swap my value into Bitcoin, then I'm going to preserve some of my monetary energy. And at some point, perhaps the central bank will say, I guess probably we should stop printing so much money because all of the money is flowing out of our currency into this other store of value. And that creates a check and a balance and hopefully some goodness, some virtue in the world, a good thing.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I am actually thinking the same. And you were just talking about the Federal Reserve, about central banks. So let's stick with that topic, because one of the most interesting things here this year, actually probably the most interesting things, were all the happenings around this coronavirus or the pandemic, especially when it comes to monetary policy. Because everyone saw after the Black Thursday, it was not only a lot of currency being printed into oblivion and pumped into the system through the secondary markets. No, actually what, in my opinion, was the most interesting thing here, especially when it comes to currency expansion, was that the reserve for the retail banks was actually put to zero from, I don't know, 5% or so to zero. So the potential currency printing, not only by the central banks, but also by retail banks, is now put until infinity. And I can see so many people taking loans and pumping that into hard assets, partial hard assets, into stocks and so on, and also into Bitcoin. Do you think that maybe a hyperinflation is even looming anytime in the future? Or do you think that this is maybe a little bit too, a little bit too radical?
I'm not sure. I'm not going to forecast hyperinflation and complete collapse in the near term. I do think it's very insightful of you to note that that reserve ratio went from 5% to zero. And I'm reminded of a brilliant insight that Saifedean Ammous, the guy that wrote the Bitcoin Standard, he's writing a book called The Fiat Standard. And when you think about Bitcoin Standard versus the gold standard versus the fiat standard, you realize that the problem with the gold standard is gold miners produce 2% more gold every year. It's hard, but they can create it. Over 100 years, that means you lose 85 to 90% of all your money because the gold miners are your enemy. Well, the brilliant insight that Saifedean had is that fractional reserve banks, or banks, are fiat miners. If you actually have a 5% reserve ratio, you can take $1 million of reserves and you can create $20 million worth of currency, which debases everybody else's currency. So the fractional banks, the banks have always been creating more currency, and the central bank's been creating more currency. But what we just saw when that rate went to zero is the fractional banks were able, they were able to create unmitigated amount of additional fiat currency. So the central banks are only part of the challenge. The fractional banks are the other set of players that are debasing the monetary supply. And I think you're right, it's been underestimated. And I think the it's rational to ask the question, just when is all this money that's being created by banks going to manifest itself? Yeah, you know, and I think, well, the first answer is it already is, if you define inflation as asset inflation. Like, we already have, you know, hyperinflation or rampant inflation in assets. Right. You know where you have real hyperinflation, if you want to use that term, it would be in a short term bond that pays you $50,000 a year in income. At LIBOR at 550 basis points, that's like $1 million bond. It costs you $1 million for Social Security if you don't take any duration risk, no long-term interest rate risk, and no credit risk. It used to be for $1 million, you could have risk-free retirement. And LIBOR today is like 20 basis points. So it would cost you $25 million for the same bond. And so in 10 years, the bond went from $1 million to $25 million. And if I told you Social Security, that thing that you're working to buy, it went up by a factor of 25, you would describe that as hyperinflation. So that's a high quality asset. There are a lot of assets that are inflating at 10%, 15%, 20%, 30% a year, but they're not measured by any government economist. But if you want the asset, they're rapidly inflating outside of your reach. So I would say there you see rampant inflation. I think that we're going to see more inflation in other goods and services. I think that the pure assets, financial assets that professional money managers can buy in 5 minutes, those immediately inflate in response to central bank moves, and they gradually inflate in response to fractional bank, non-central bank, right? So they're creeping up, but because all these money managers realize they have to own these assets. I think that commercial real estate, probably luxury real estate in Dubai or luxury real estate in the Hamptons or Miami Beach or places where Palm Beach where people want to live, they creep up at a slightly slower rate, but that's because those money managers are looking for where they put their personal wealth, and they will drive 10, 20, 30, 40% inflation of those. I think that the consumer assets, the consumer goods and services, they haven't inflated as aggressively because during the lockdowns, no one could buy them if they wanted to. Like for a while, it's like, I can't travel, I can't. But as we start to move into the post-COVID environment, say after the vaccine, once there's a vaccine and once people regularize or normalize movement, then I think what we're going to see is there's a lot of impaired assets. There's a lot of pent-up demand. There's going to be too much demand for supplies. You will see energy-intensive products. A Caesar salad prepared table side at a very elegant restaurant, that will double in price. You will see highly manufactured, information-rich products not go up so fast. Like if I can stamp out 100 billion Apple Watches or iPhones, then I will stamp them out. And if I can stamp like YouTube videos and Netflix streaming videos, they're not going to go up in price that much because they're 99% information, 1% electricity. But what will go up in price is things that require human labor, energy, material, mass, right? Custom built, custom manufactured stuff that will be concealed in the CPI estimates and in the inflation estimates, because they'll change the market basket to not include those things. And because it's like everything that you wanted to buy and hold in your hand has been dematerialized to run on an iPhone. And now it's software. So you don't have inflation in those things. But if you ever decide to go back and buy that book or buy that thing, it's going to be more expensive because
it's called because CP it's lie, by the way.
To move mass around.
I would call it the CP lie, because the real CPI is actually not really factoring in what's really important, right? So that is a very, very good point. Sorry, didn't want to interrupt you. You have any other points to add here?
I would say on the subject of inflation, the most important insight that anybody could have is inflation is a vector. You can calculate a different inflation for any type of product or any market basket of goods and services and assets. And if you don't include assets along with the goods and services in your market basket of desirables, you haven't established a relevant inflation measure or cost of capital to be concerned about. Every individual has to define the desirable market basket for themselves. If you desire to sleep in your parents' basement the rest of your life, then your market basket of aspirational goods, services, and assets will be different And if you desire to be rich and have a yacht and a house and a jet, right, your market basket of assets is going to be different. So the inflation rate is a function of your aspiration, you know, and a family of four that wants to live in a suburb with a yard and send their kids to college has a different market basket of assets. So I would say to anybody, define the assets, the goods and the services that you aspire to over the next decade, then figure out what the inflation rate is on those things and ask yourself the question, how will the economic policies change them? Because if you wanted to retire with no risk and never work the rest of your life using a risk-free government bond, the price of that went up by a factor of 25. So some things are going up fast.
Yes.
And that will determine how you feel about the macroeconomic environment. And it will probably determine what kind of portfolio you invest your assets in and how you choose to cope with this.
Yeah, well, when it comes to me, I have 95% in Bitcoin, as I already said, because I know about all these properties, and I'm so grateful that you are actually entering this space and you are educating people in a rapid space. I see you in many interviews, and the way you are actually convincing also high net worth individuals, I personally think that your moves and also your interviews, all yours, everything you are saying and your announcements about the purchases, they are actually moving the markets. Before I'm actually going here into the next content point, I just have like two more questions. I wanted to share also some thoughts because you were talking about the fractional reserve banking. I would actually call it now the no reserve banking. And in the last 50 years, yeah. We basically,
yeah. Fraction is zero, divide by zero.
This is not even a fraction anymore, right? And we had such a crazy development since 1971 where Nixon said that temporarily, we know these government temporary measurements, they are usually permanent. We are going to remove the gold standard from the US dollar. This was not temporary, this was permanent. And then we went from a gold-backed system into a fractional reserve system. And this March, actually this year, this was so underestimated news, we went from fractional reserve system into a no reserve system. And this is the moment when, in my opinion, we are going to go parabolic and nothing goes up in a straight line forever. This is why I personally think that the monetary system as of right now has to inevitably collapse anytime in the future, because as trust actually gets worse, as we can see the pandemic actually bringing unemployment levels to record highs, and as every single politician doesn't want to see a market crash in their legislation period, I personally think the currency printing is going to be completely put ad absurdum. And also we will see retail banks on top of the M0 and M1 monetary supply create even more currency through debt. So I personally think hyperinflation is probably going to come, and this monetary system as we know it right now is also going to collapse. Maybe even we are going to skip a deflationary period. These are my thoughts, and maybe if you have any additional thoughts on that, you are of course free to share them. And then I would go into the last two quick questions here before we are wrapping it up for today.
Yeah. One of the most brilliant Bitcoin maximalist in the world today is Ross Stevens, the chairman of Stone Ridge and NYDIG. And Ross wrote an annual letter to his shareholders. And in the annual letter, he said, and I quote, "Each citizen now has a choice. You can stay on the fiat standard in which some people get to produce unlimited new units of money for free, just not you, or opt into the Bitcoin standard in which no one gets to do that, including you." And I thought that was the most brilliant statement I have heard in a long time. And it describes exactly what you just said. In the fiat standard, central banks and non-fractional bankers have the right to produce unlimited amounts of currency for their benefit, for their purposes, just not you. You can't, they can. That's the fiat standard system. And if you choose to stay in that system and accumulate wealth in that system, if you buy bonds that pay fiat coupon, if you buy stocks that pay fiat, that are valued on fiat cash flow, if you buy real estate that collects fiat rents, if you store money in fiat cash, you have opted into the fiat standard where someone else can print unlimited units of money, just not you. And your choice is to switch to the Bitcoin standard where nobody can do that. And it's only now dawning on a lot of the world that they have to make this choice. Everybody has to make this choice. And that is the overarching driver. And once you understand that, you understand why Bitcoin is critical to the world order and to peace and prosperity and to the human race. I mean, everybody on Earth, all 7.8 billion people, they need some store of monetary energy that they can trust and rely upon. And so you can't build anything of beauty. You can't build a company. You can't build a country. You can't build a family. You can't build anything on a crumbling foundation. And that's why Bitcoin is really important. And that's why, you know, people that are believers in Bitcoin, we're not just here for the technology. We're not just here because it's a good investment. We believe in Bitcoin because for the first time in human history, we've invented an effective monetary network that's going to solve the problem that everybody on Earth has, and they all have to solve it. How do I collect and store and channel my life force, my monetary energy in a virtuous fashion over time? If I have no hope, if I expect that all of my life is going to be drained out of me in 1, 2, 3, 5, 10 years, what's the point of planning for anything? How can you look out a decade or 5 years or 3 years or 20 years? What are you going to believe in if everything is going to zero? Right. And that's why we're big evangelists of Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is hope and Bitcoin is integrity and Bitcoin is truth. And that happens to make it a pretty good investment idea, but it's a good investment idea because of its truthfulness and integrity and functionality, not the other way around.
True, true. And I mean, it is actually a savior, a scapegoat for all the people who are being robbed by the central banks. And we just have to look at the second world countries, third world countries, if it's Zimbabwe or Argentina, wherever the inflation is very high, we see a very high correlation actually of people adopting Bitcoin. So we can already see this happening right now. And I think it's just trickling down from third world countries to second world countries to first world countries. And I think maybe the last man standing might be the United States. So thank you so much for that. And I have just like one more question actually before I would be wrapping it up for today. And I want to squeeze one in here because one thing I really was asking me since the last few weeks, MicroStrategy was buying more Bitcoin, $650 million worth of Bitcoin more here at the level of 21,900 something. It was actually the wick down here in the market. Afterwards, we never saw these prices again so far. And the question I was actually asking is, ex post, of course, this was a brilliant decision, right? But in this moment, I was asking myself, why is this very big company giving out convertible debt? Because in the end of the day, if, which I don't think would ever happen, you would be wrong about Bitcoin, then you would have to give some equity, or like you would have to find some cash to pay back that debt. And usually rule number one for me personally, and for also some many of my friends who are investing in Bitcoin, would be never buy Bitcoin with debt, because we are actually escaping Bitcoin, because it is not a debt-based money. Like every currency is a debt-based money. So why did you make that move, which was ex post once again the right decision so far? And what would be your reasoning behind buying Bitcoin with convertible debt?
Well, let's make a distinction. I would not recommend that anybody buy Bitcoin with excessive margin leverage. For example, I wouldn't take a 10 to 1 or 20 to 1 leverage bet on Bitcoin, where if the Bitcoin trades down 10%, you get liquidated and wiped out. That's not good. You know, I think in general, any loan that is marked to market against the thing you're buying, you know, like if you basically you had a loan to value of 50%, right? You buy Bitcoin, and if it trades down 50%, you get wiped out. That, you know, even that could happen. You know, would I borrow up to 20%? Well, maybe, but a mark to market margin loan is risky. On the other hand, if you borrow money non-recourse or borrow money that's not marked to market against the thing you're investing in, it's a different risk profile. So we actually borrowed money in a convertible instrument. It wasn't secured. It wasn't a secured loan. It was an unsecured convertible loan. The primary benefit of the loan was the people that bought it got warrants on the company stock above $398 a share. So they're actually giving us a 0.75% interest loan in return for warrants that are trading above where the market was at the time. We have the money and we can invest it in something. So now we just get to the question of, is it rational for a business to borrow money to invest in something? Well, what I would say is everything on earth was built with money borrowed to invest in. For example, you're in Dubai right now. Walk outside and look up at all those buildings. They were all built with debt.
Yes.
Okay. When you get on an airplane, the airplane's financed. When you have a house, how many people buy a house with a mortgage loan? Most people. When you buy a car, so people buy cars, houses, airplanes, boats, commercial buildings, they build highways. Like the world is full of stuff that was built with debt. How many companies borrow money in order to invest in their business? Amazon does. I mean, like lots of Apple does. By the way, Apple, you know, like the world's full of companies. In fact, 95% of companies have borrowed money. So borrowing money to, there probably is no piece of commercial real estate ever developed that didn't have a loan on it, right?
Yep.
So it's not really strange, in my opinion, to borrow money in order to invest in a business venture, which is what we did. It's just that we were the first company to do it in the Bitcoin space, right? We borrowed money to invest in a big tech monetary network growing more than 100% a year that's 95% dominant. Okay, so is that better idea than borrowing money to buy a house? What's the odds that your house price is going to double in value every year for a decade?
For sure.
I mean, not high, but every single person that's ever bought a house probably took a mortgage out to buy the house. So my point really is we're in business to make rational investments, and businesses make rational investments and execute their strategy using a combination of debt and equity. So you can finance it with equity. You can finance it with debt. We actually finance things with a combination of those two things. And that's just what businesses do. So it would be aggressive if I took a margin loan, especially a margin loan, you know, with like 80% loan to value, right? Yep. And it's pretty obvious, you know, if the thing trades down 20% and you're 80% loan to value, you get liquidated. So that's an aggressive strategy, taking an uncorrelated loan against other property. Basically mortgaging a company, we borrowed money against the cash flows of our business in order to invest in another business, which is going up more than 100% a year, right? All we did is we just used our capital to invest in a line of business. You know, by the way, when Disney built Disney World, you know, I bet they also took out debt to build amusement parks. You know, and when Emirates Airlines buys airplanes, oftentimes they'll finance them with debt. So it's not uncommon for companies to use debt financing in order to expand businesses if they believe in the business.
I completely agree with you. And once again, it was the right decision. If I was in your position, because I am such a big Bitcoin believer, maybe I would have made the same decision. In the end of the day, I usually just I just say like taking a loan for something which is cash flow yielding makes for me personally more sense than taking a loan for something which is a hard asset, even though your success chances are very high, especially here, maybe on the tipping point of a new up and coming bull market. So I just wanted to distinguish here between cash flow yielding assets, for example, like airplanes for Emirates or like real estate. And then you have cash flow yielding assets. You can take the cash flow, pay back the loan. That was the only thing where I was not understanding this move.
I think it's an orthodoxy, but if you thought about it a different way, you would say, would you rather have an asset that yields 5% interest in like 5% coupon that's taxable, or have a zero coupon asset that doubles every year? There's not, I mean, which of the two would you want? Like, isn't it pretty obvious?
If you're asking me, of course.
But the thing that's doubling every year is yielding you 100% after tax. And the thing that's yielding 5% is 3% after tax. So at the end of the day, it makes a lot more sense to own the thing that's appreciating in principle tax deferred. And the real question is, do you believe in it or not? If you believe that Bitcoin was going to go up 20% a year, if you believe that and you had a house, you could borrow $1 million against the house, take $1 million against the house and pay 3% interest, invest in Bitcoin and get 100% tax-free interest.
Yeah.
Like you would have a 98% arbitrage. Right? Your $1 million loan, if you don't borrow the money, right? Then if you don't borrow the money, then what do you have? You have $1 million in equity and it goes up at the price of the house. If you borrow the money, then you're going to get $1 million. And then in a year, it's $2 million. And in a year, it's $4 million. And in the third year, it's $8 million. And in the fourth year, it's $16 million. And the fifth year, it's $32 million. And the sixth year is $64 million. And the seventh year is $128 million. The eighth year is $256 million. The ninth year is $512 million. And you know where we're ending up. You would be a billionaire at the end of 10 years if you took a $1 million loan and you would have paid $30,000 a year, or $300,000 in interest. So would you pay $300,000 in interest to make $1 billion?
Obviously. I mean, if you're asking me, yes. I was just asking because I wanted to bring a little bit of a controversial question here in that arguments. And I think your shareholders, they truly appreciated that, because if you're just looking at the stock price, I mean, obviously it was the right decision and everyone won, actually, including me personally, who is holding a lot of Bitcoin. And ever since you made this announcement, we are significantly going up. So thank you so much for sharing all your thoughts about that. And I want to come to an end because I know your time is very valuable. Even though time is also not as scarce as Bitcoin, as we know, time is in a continuum with space. If you move through space, time is going slower and Bitcoin is completely not able to inflate. So even time is not scarce as Bitcoin, but I know your time is pretty scarce, maybe close to the Bitcoin scarcity. I want to come to the last question here. And my last question is, even though I know you're probably like me here, more like a Bitcoin maximalist, I'm holding 5% in altcoins. I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts on Ethereum? Because even though Ethereum has a completely different use case, it is not as scarce as Bitcoin. I personally think it is some kind of a supercomputer. If Bitcoin is digital gold, Ethereum is digital oil. So do you have any thoughts about Ethereum? Are you bullish on it? Are you bearish on it? Would you ever at any time in the future maybe consider investing into Ethereum?
I think that a simplistic way to look at the crypto industry is you have one institutional grade safe haven asset, which is Bitcoin, digital gold. And that is an appropriate thing to put an institutional treasury into for 30 years. Then you have one unicorn, which is Ethereum, like Uber, Airbnb, massively successful, exciting thing that you know, you can't dispute the fact that there's a lot of monetary energy in Ethereum and it holds a lot of promise. Much higher risk, like Airbnb or WeWork or Uber, and a lot more questions, a lot more complexity to it. Then you have a whole set of venture capital startups. I mean, a whole set of other, you know, cryptos that are attempting to provide functionality. And some of them are playing in the Ethereum space, right? They're tokens on Ethereum, and some are competitive to Ethereum, and some of them are swapping, you know, are working with Ethereum. So there's a whole set of things out there. I think that the theoretical use of a crypto, I mean, crypto, the entire approach of crypto is you're trying to create a living creature in cyberspace that transcends a company or a country, right? You're trying to release something in cyberspace that will live on its own. And you want to do that because you don't want to be crippled by a CEO or a company or a regulatory jurisdiction. You want it to be something which is of the people of the world. And Bitcoin clearly has succeeded. It's of the people of the world. There's no country, there's no company. You know, you can't change it. It's its own thing. It's a life force of sorts. Is there a place for other crypto networks? I mean, they're almost like each crypto is like a religion, right? Like, do you worship the religion of thermodynamics and integrity and truth? That's kind of what Bitcoin is. Do you worship the religion of privacy? Well, if you worship the religion of privacy, a privacy coin that's really optimized for privacy, that's what you're trying to release. Do you worship the religion of smart contracts between anonymous smart contracts, cross-border smart contracts? If it could be done in a centralized network, then you're going to have competition from a centralized exchange like a Binance or a Coinbase or whatever. But the negative of centralized exchanges is they have regulators, right? But it's not just the one negative. They also have CEOs, and they also have, right? So they have corporations and they have Nexus. And so if it can be done in a centralized way, the advantage is it's a billion times cheaper and faster to do it. And so there will be a Binance, there will be a Coinbase, there will be a Square, there will be a PayPal. But then what about the things that you don't want to be done that way? And maybe you want to cross jurisdictions because it's going to speed up technology innovation. To the extent that someone can create a crypto network that speeds up innovation, that is deemed as a valuable function other than store of value. It can't be store of value because Bitcoin holds that slot. Sure. It needs to be another thing, provenance, you know, functionality, privacy, currency. One of those areas, then it comes to life. And then you just have to ask the question, right? Like, what are the struggles, right? Like in privacy, the privacy cryptos will have to transcend the law enforcement concern, right? The currency cryptos, like stable coins, they will have to transcend the concerns of central banks, right? The central bankers are, you know, Christine Lagarde, she said, well, we're not really concerned about Bitcoin. It's very volatile. We're concerned about stable coins.
Yep. I remember.
Right? So because it's like, well, if I can print 100 trillion euro dollars or euros, right? That's a lot more threatening to them if it moves on non-KYC AML rails or it's done outside of the standard regulatory banking compliance structure. So cryptocurrencies, they will have a set of regulatory concerns they have to overcome, but they may live, right? They may live in that, you know, like is anybody going to block the formation of a crypto dollar in Africa? I don't know. The Africans might need one, right? And so maybe no country in Africa is going to shut it down because it'll be deemed to be, I've heard people say in South America and Africa, they really want the crypto dollar. They don't want the Bitcoin, but they want the stable dollar. That's what they want. And so maybe those things form and they fill that niche and that works well. And maybe the privacy thing comes to life. And with regard to DeFi, well, it'll come to life everywhere if it's viewed as a technical innovation that is more functional, that evolves faster than the centralized versions. But it will struggle if it is viewed as a competitor or as regulatory arbitrage defeating the regulated exchanges, right? So there's space in cyberspace to create new crypto creatures. The most successful crypto creature is Bitcoin, right? That's an example of success. And the use case, the total addressable market of Bitcoin is $300 trillion. It's the biggest total addressable market of any digital network ever created in the history of the world. Bigger than Google, bigger than Apple, bigger than Facebook, bigger than Amazon, it's bigger than the internet in a way because it's the internet of money, to paraphrase Andreas, right? It's all about money. I think that there's some interesting appeal to smart contracts and there's interesting appeal in these other areas of functionality, currency, provenance, et cetera. I think that they're all at the venture phase. They're adventures. And something will happen and someone will figure something out good. But if it's going to be a successful crypto as opposed to digital network, you're going to have to mate technology and ideology. Someone's going to have to love it so much that they'll lay down in front of a tank and die for it. If everybody in Africa is willing to fight and die for a privacy coin that emulates the dollar, it'll be successful, right? There has to be that ideology. They're like religions, right? These are like the 21st century religions. Do you believe in it and love it with all of your heart? And are you going to feed the flame? Because the altar of the Middle Ages, the altar of the Middle Ages has become the mining rig of the 21st century. If you would run the mining rig to mine Ethereum in your home, it's your religion. If you would run Zcash, if you would run another stable coin as your mining rig, then you're worshiping that religion. And now the question is, are you going to protect that mining rig when someone comes to kick your door in and take it away from you? Because the religions that made it through the dark ages, right, had people that they were willing to go underground and protect it. So, and then on the other hand, if it's just doing what Binance does, why you better find some arbitrage, some nuance. Maybe it's a regulatory arbitrage, but maybe if you can come up with some totally decentralized idea that causes people in cyberspace to be able to cooperate with each other 1,000 times faster. Like, for example, I mean, the argument against KYC AML is it slows everybody down. It takes them 3 months or 6 months in order to interact with each other instead of 6 seconds. And if I could take it to 6 seconds, then maybe I could trade with 197,000 counterparties on a Saturday afternoon. And then maybe that creates an emergent behavior, like in nature, some emergent process, which creates something of beauty. if you can create that emergent process, then you can birth something that's going to live on in cyberspace. And I think that Bitcoin is that emergent process for monetary energy. And it doesn't need to be that much more than that, right? That's enough. That's like plankton. It's the base layer in the ecosystem. But then, you know, there's birds that fly, and there's fish that swim, and there's sharks that eat the fish. These are also life forms. And by the way, nature creates a lot of them. And, you know, the shark bird doesn't work, you know, like sometimes you try to do too much. So what do I think about Ethereum? I think it's evolving. There are all these things it wants to be, right? I mean, Ethereum 1.0 is a life form. Ethereum 2.0 is a different life form. So let's be clear, right? I can't give you an opinion on Ethereum 2.0 until it comes to life. And 3 years to 5 years after it comes to life, I'll tell you what I think of it. You know, and Ethereum 1.0, we can see what we think of that. And, you know, it's interesting world we live in. I think you just have to evaluate each of these things, and you have to be honest about what is that life form trying to do. If you wish, like we talk about path dependence, if you wish to dominate the ecosystem, you need to be a unique, beautiful creature that does something really well and better than all other creatures in the ecosystem that would compete with you for that energy. And so I think Ethereum is not going to displace and should not really compete with Bitcoin. I think it's a mistake. I think anytime people say Ethereum is money, it's a mistake, because it's like, one, they're competing with a creature which is actually better engineered to be that. If I really want money, I don't want 100 other features. I don't want all the other features that Ethereum has. I like the fact that it's stodgy and slow and secure and reliable. Like, for example, if you're an engineer and you came to me and said, I have 187 ideas to improve Bitcoin, I would say, like, slow it down. Like, let's not, right? Let's go very carefully, very slowly, because it already is good enough to be $300 trillion. It's got the functionality. It's done. It's genetically completed. It's like those cockroaches or the lobster from 300 million years ago. Stop screwing with it. God created it. He dropped it in the world. And let it be what it is, like plankton. Just let it be. If you want to play God and you want to create a new creature in cyberspace, I think the lesson is you better design the creature very carefully. You better have a clear thought about what that creature is going to do, what the purpose of it is, what part of the ecosystem is going to live in. And if you're true to yourself, if you, you know, and if that creature, you know, is true to itself, then maybe it will prosper and it will occupy its place in the ecosystem. But, you know, there's not a lot of space for like a shark duck,
yeah,
you know, yeah, that lives in the trees, right? That's not a good idea. So you better figure out what you want to be when you grow up, and you should commit to that thing, and you should be comfortable with it. And then you're most likely to be successful.
All right. I would agree with that. Even though I'm holding a little bit of altcoins, I would agree that Bitcoin is probably the best bet right now. So for everyone who is maybe overexposed into altcoins, should just watch the last 10 minutes here once again, because I agree with that. Because in the end of the day, it all comes down to scarcity. Because Bitcoin is more scarce as time, as I already said. Bitcoin is more scarce as watches, as paintings, as basically everything in the history of humans. I never saw anything as scarce as Bitcoin. So please, guys, reconsider if you are overexposed in altcoins. I'm always saying that every single day here in the videos. And
can I end with a thought? Yeah. Can I end with a thought? If I was talking to anybody that traded altcoins right now, what I would say is, we've got something called Bitcoin that solves a very simple problem. And that problem is store of value for the human race. And there's $300 trillion worth of money in defective alt assets that don't store value. and Bitcoin is a small fraction of that, there's no reason why it shouldn't get 100 times bigger as people figure it out. If I gave you something that solved a problem that's going to get 100 times bigger, and all you got to do is hold it and wait, it's a, you know, why do you want to juggle razor blades and chase after very complicated trading strategies and deal with things that are risky that you don't understand when there's nothing on earth that's going to be more valuable than storing the monetary energy of humanity? And Bitcoin has already solved the problem. So you have a chance to buy into the most important digital network of our lifetime, maybe the most important digital network of 1,000 years. Okay, so if you want to gamble or invest in other things, I wouldn't tell you you can't buy Tesla. You can buy a house, you can buy Tesla. If you think that a certain crypto asset is going to dominate in some area of stablecoin, private coin, if you passionately believe in smart contracts or DeFi or whatever, and you know it's an investment, like a venture investment, go into it with your eyes open. Make sure you understand it. Make sure that you understand why it's the superior creature and it's going to defeat every other creature. But if you're dismissing Bitcoin right now, Bitcoin is going to be 100x bigger than Apple, and you can be there first. Why would you do anything other than invest some and wait for the rest of the world to figure out that you're, it's not a question of competing Bitcoin versus altcoins. What, you know, it's 0.2% of the world's money is in the crypto pond. It's really a question of, where would you like to be positioned when the $300 trillion of money discovers it needs to come and solve its problem?
Yep.
And it finds Bitcoin. It's like, why wouldn't you want to, you know, to be owning some of that real estate? It's the simplest, most powerful investment opportunity of our lifetime. And by the way, I've invested in everything. I was an early investor in Apple and Facebook and Amazon and Google and OpenTable and eBay and PayPal. And I made huge amounts of money. I made 10x, 20x my money in those things. And let me tell you, none of them looked as good as this looks to me. This is like, you know, just screaming. It's, you know, I have anxiety. When Bitcoin was 9,500, I was buying it with anxiety that someone was going to figure out before I woke up how good this was and the price would get away from me. And that's how I felt. You know, it's like, beautiful. You're here, it's right in front of our face. So it's an opportunity.
It is so obvious, actually. I have to say the same, but it's always like that. I mean, if you gave someone the Amazon business model in 1998, of course, someone who was smart back then, he read it, he would understand it, but these information were not available for everyone. So everyone who is actually deep diving into Bitcoin, it is getting so blatantly obvious because, I mean, if the demand for watches increase, they just print more, they just create more. If the demand for US dollar increases, they print more. Demand for real estate increases, they build higher, they build artificial islands. But if the demand for Bitcoin increases, the only mechanism, actually, if you only have demand, supply, and price, is the valuation to increase. And it is so blatantly obvious in the end of the day. And with the network effects actually getting bigger and bigger and taking over the world like a kraken, you are talking in energy. Everything is energy. You want to attract energy. And the best thing to attract monetary energy is by holding Bitcoin because it is scarce. So for me, it is extremely valuable, extremely obvious. So thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, because I really think because of your position and because of your name and your reputation, you are bringing in more and more reputable people into the space. And the more reputable people are coming into the space, we have 3,000 billionaires approximately, the more of them are coming into the space, the faster the frequency gets actually of new people getting into the space, and also, of course, of more billion-dollar entities getting into the space. And I think you are with one of the first movers here, making a very big step. So really, thank you so much for that. Everyone watching here, if you want to say thank you to Michael Saylor here, not only smash up the like button on that video, go over to Twitter and follow him. I can tell you something. You are going to get pumped here because he's probably the only person who can pump me here, the biggest Bitcoin bull on YouTube, probably. So thank you so much for that. Do you have any concluding thoughts here before I'm wrapping it up for today?
Yeah, my concluding thought is on this issue of network effect. A lot of people, they understand there's a massive network effect for Bitcoin, and they refer to Metcalfe's law, you know, and Metcalfe's law is like about the square of the sum of the nodes. I just want to make clear that I look at it, it's not just Metcalfe's law, it's like the laws of gravity. This is a gravitational network. And so you got to think about Kepler's laws, and you got to think about, it's not 10 people on the network. What happens when there's 10 billionaires on the network and each one of the billionaires brings a billion times as much money? And so the monetary energy has a gravitational pull, a magnetic pull. And what you have right now is the world's greatest digital network forming with monetary energy with an extreme gravitational pull. As people join, they bring their marketing leverage, they bring their political leverage, they bring their monetary leverage, they bring their technical know-how, they're bringing more functionality to the network. And you've got this collapsing of a planet, if you will. Some people say it is a black hole, some people say it's like a planetary body. I would say we passed the event horizon where just more and more of this monetary energy is going to collapse. And it's like the creation, a massive chain reaction, a fire in cyberspace. The monetary energy feeds itself, creates the suction, sucks in more monetary energy. And if people had, we don't even have the models to describe this. We don't have the math to describe it. If they had that, then they would be even more bullish because this network effect is much more powerful than the network effect of a Facebook or the network effect of a Google because of that monetary energy and gravitational component. That's just tremendously exciting.
Thank you very much for that. I can't wait to put this video out because there was more bullishness involved than in my last 10 videos combined here probably. And I'm always trying to be as bullish as possible. Thank you so much for that. I truly appreciate your time. I know that is very valuable. It is very scarce. So thank you so much for that. I really hope that we are going to get together here anytime in the future again. Maybe we are going to meet each other here again at 80,000, at 100,000 US dollars. And we are really evaluating this situation here.
Hey, I want to thank you for supporting the space. You know, and I think you're doing a very important job of educating people. And right now, this is all about education, you know, and you never know. Sometimes you create good content and it goes viral. And all it has to do, by the way, is reach one person. You talked about that billionaire, right? If you reach that one person and you could describe what's happening and that one person buys, they might buy $1 billion of this. But, you know, if they buy $1 billion, they'll tell 10 other people. You know, every rich person in UAE knows every rich person in the Middle East. So once you actually get through to the people with that monetary energy, it could go to 100 billionaires, and then it will go to all their employees, and then it will go to all their creditors and all their banks and all their associates. So you never know who you're going to touch.
Yeah.
Which is why we just got to keep trying. You know, that's why I like talking with you, and I don't mind spending the time, because if we can just save that one person, it'll make a world of difference. And, you know, maybe it's the one individual working middle-class person, and it's going to save his family. Because we talked about it, $10,000 doubling 10 times makes a big difference to your life, right? But then maybe it's the other person, maybe it's that one person that's got connections with the government, and they're going to protect and defend and promulgate this. So you never know, or maybe it's a journalist.
Yeah.
But every single person could make a difference, and anybody could make a difference. And the thing that's holding them back is just education, man. They just don't understand it. When they understand it a different way, when they have the mental model, then the world's going to be a better place. And I really feel like everybody on the planet needs this for one way, one reason or the other. And so we're doing good work here.
I mean, in the end of my studies, actually, my my paper in the end was about that only human capital can preserve long-term growth of a nation. So human capital is important. Education is important. This is why actually I put my purpose of educating the world about Bitcoin, reaching as many people as possible with my content. And as of right now, our channel, MM Crypto, is, I'm happy to say that, the most viewed Bitcoin channel in the world. So thank you so much for joining here. I think we are in the same boat when it comes to Bitcoin. We have the exact same purpose, and I'm truly grateful for you joining this space, and potentially, because of our discussion here, in the future even more people joining our boat here. So thank you so much for that. And yeah, any last words? Sorry,
thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. And thanks everyone for watching. Thanks for watching until the end. Thanks for subscribing to the channel, pressing the subscription button here below, pressing the bell, and very importantly, pressing on all, because then you can make sure that you get notified here when we are releasing the next video. And maybe anytime in the future, it is going to be a video with Michael Saylor once again. Thank you so much. Thanks, Michael. Thanks everyone watching. And we will see you very soon at the next one of MM Crypto. And as always, guys, as always, bye-bye.